The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Anyway, I did develop the Easterners' prejudice against L.A., and, you know, after a while it got to me. It was great while it lasted. So I felt, I've got to get out of town. But not so far that I couldn't still commute to USC, which I still do, by the way. I teach one class a week now, but I love it, and that's my life. However, it's 100 miles each way. And I don't know what the laws are here, but I was in New York last night, and those percipient New Yorkers, banned cell phone use while driving a couple of years ago. We just did it. Do you have it? Do you have it here? Oh, boy, please, let me talk to the governor while I'm here. Is the governor present, by the way? I was looking for this for a long time, this law. By the way, I'm a road warrior because 100 miles, what am I going to do? I'm the guy, if you've ever been on the freeways in L.A., I'm the guy in the little red car right behind you at 95 flashing the lights. I'm sorry, that's me. Anyway, I think the fine is $100. I feel that's too little. I think first offense, $10,000. Second offense, execution. That's how I feel. So anyway, we had been looking in Santa Barbara. It's within striking distance. I wanted to get into a smaller town where I could walk to do my business instead of getting in a car all the time. We looked for about a year. We liked old houses. We didn't want, you know, one of these new stucco boxes. And I gave up. I couldn't find anything. And I was kind of grumpy. And my wife went up to look at this house that was listed for sale, the Frank Lloyd Wright house. And I discouraged her. I said, oh, give me a break. You know, it's probably some falling down Usonian house of three bedrooms with a flat, leaky roof and so on. And incidentally, there was a lot of serendipity involved in this. The week before, this was when The Road to Wellville came out, I had been sent to New York by my publisher. My wife came with me. And it was a time when I was doing a TV show and also a performance in the park with Patti Smith. So they put us at the old Stanhope Hotel. Across the street is the Metropolitan Museum. My wife, bored witless, spent 3 days in the Frank Lloyd Wright room, where they have taken the Francis Little house and taken the living room out and put it in the whole room. So a day later, she found this house. And we would be divorced now if I hadn't come up and bought it that day. So for 16 years, we've been fixing up this house. It's centennial now, and we finally got it done. A little hubris involved here. We finally got the woodwork done. The second owner, I'm sorry, I'll have to name her, Mrs. Blickenstaff, she, I believe, is the one who painted the wood, which is anathema to Frank Lloyd Wright. So this fall, we had it all sanded in misery, and, you know, we'd done some ourselves, but we got people to sand it. And just as it was done, and I was admiring how great it is, the tea fire struck. I don't know if you read about the tea fire in Santa Barbara. It hit in late November, and it was about 5:30 in the evening, and someone phoned and said, look outside, and there was the fire sitting on the hill over us. Fortunately for us, but unfortunately for 231 other homeowners, it blew west of us, but a pretty scary occasion. But I can report to you that the house was standing when I left 5 days ago, and we hope that it will be when I get back. At any rate, I had long contemplated writing about Frank Lloyd Wright, and I finally got around to it. I thought it would be very special to write about him while living in this house that I have worked on for all this time. And it was, to a degree, but I'd also written 12 other books in this house, so it was work as usual. On the other hand, I'm very lucky in that whenever I am interested in something, I can write a book about it and then find out. So that was essentially what I had in mind with this book. And I'd like to give you a little taste of it. I didn't realize what an incredible cult of Frank Lloyd Wright there is until I started to go on the tour to Oak Park and to Taliesin and see all the people speaking every language in the world lined up in the freezing cold to go on this tour. But it was worth it. I didn't want to write a conventional, straightforward narrative because I had done that with Kinsey. And also, I wasn't so much interested in telling you about him. Many people do know about him. as what his effect is on the people around him. I think this was my interest in Kinsey and Kellogg as well. You know, these are people who are extremely narcissistic. They're powerful. They create great things. But on the other hand, they don't really pay much attention to anybody else. Everybody else only exists as part of their regime. Now, novelists are not at all like this, of course. We love you. We love you. We embrace you. And we don't want you to join our church or do anything except have fun. And with that in mind, I'm going to read you a humorous part of this book. Frank Lloyd Wright was married 3 times, and he also lived with a mistress, Mamie Borthwick Cheney, who was murdered. Within 6 months of her murder, another woman came into his life, Miriam. And Miriam was a very exotic woman. She was American from the South. She had spent the last 10 years in Paris, so she was very fashionable. And she wrote him a sympathy letter. Many thousands of people wrote him sympathy letters. This was a big news, the murder of Mamie. And within 6 months, he liked her letter so much that he met her, and they became lovers within 6 months of Mamie's death. His first wife, Kitty, would not grant him a divorce, so he had to live with Miriam for 9 years until they were married. She waited, she persisted, and finally they were married. And within 6 months, she left him and went out to L.A. And so I would like to read you about that right now, and you'll find all about Miriam and her needs, wants, and desires. This is from chapter 2 of the book. It's called Miriam Agonistes. None of the doctors could help her in Los Angeles or the provincial outpost of San Diego either. Little people, all of them. Sniveling types, hand-wringers, an army of effete little bald-headed men in spectacles who were mortified of the law, as if this law had any more right to exist than prohibition. Because who was the federal government to dictate what people could and couldn't do with their own bodies, their own minds, their personal needs and wants and compulsions? Were they going to regulate needs then? Dole them out? Tax them? Miriam was so furious, so burned up and blistered with the outrage of it, that she must have been overly severe with the cabman, the driver with his hat cocked back on his head and his trace of a Valentino mustache. Because when they got to the border at Tijuana, he stopped the car, turned round in the seat, and demanded payment in full. Insolently, out of his insolent little pig's eyes. "This is as far as I go," he said, and she couldn't place his accent. She was immovable. She felt her face concretize, the pores sealing up, the muscles round her mouth and eyes going to stone. Nonsense. Drive on. There was a customs man standing off to the left of the car, a slouching, congenital idiot with a lazy eye and bad teeth, and he'd already showed them his smile and waved them on. No searches here, no passports required. And he was giving her a curious look now, as if he'd seen everything in his day, every sort of indecision and cataclysm, women 4 and 5 months gone, heading down to La Clinica for the procedure that would make them right again, rum runners with their empty trucks, day trippers and ethnologists and rock collectors. But this was a new wrinkle altogether. "No," he said. "No more." And he shoved his way out of the car and tried to pull open the back door, but she held fast to the handle. "Get out," he insisted. And it gave her a small pulse of pleasure to hear the tremor in his voice. The war was already won. "I won't," she said, just to savor the words on her lips. "Now, I've paid you to take me to Tijuana, and I won't budge until you fulfill your end of the bargain." She looked round her in growing outrage. The customs man, a river of Mexicans in pajamas and serapes, mules, dogs, Indian eyes, Indian hair, dust, muck, filth, the street vendors and beggars in their cutaway rags, and hanging over it all, the heat. The impossible, punishing heat that stewed the odor of decay till she could barely breathe. "Move on," she demanded. He saw the look in her eyes, saw the way her face had set, and he didn't even try to Jew her out of an extra 2 bits, as any of the rest of them would. He just shrugged, climbed back into the cab, and put the car in gear. A moment later, they were lurching down the rutted streets, the human circus of Mexican poverty unfolding outside the window like a mural in a moving picture. She was uncomfortable, feeling the heat, dizzy from the stench. She'd sweated through her undergarments and the seat of her dress, and her hair was gummy beneath the parrot-green caftan, which she'd chosen expressly to bring out the color of her eyes. But there was no one here to care about the color of her eyes. just peasants, campesinos. Isn't that what they called them? And what was pharmacy? A cognate, farmacia, wasn't it? She consulted the English-Spanish phrasebook in her purse and found the term under the heading of useful phrases. ¿Dónde está la farmacia? There was a dead dog beside the road, the carcass swollen beneath a second skin of insects, people strolling by as if it were some sort of monument, as if it had been molded of brass and put there by the town council to honor canine achievement. The cab lurched again, in and out of a rut, and the dog was gone. The farmacia, she said, the cords tightening in her throat. Take me to the farmacia, the first one you see. Quickly, quickly. He didn't seem to have heard her, so she repeated herself. A scorched minute blistered by. There were birds now, some sort of Mexican birds exploding up from the road. Pigeons, Mexican pigeons. The farmacia, she said. And she was beginning to feel desperate. All her outrage evaporated in the face of the hopelessness of this place, these peasants, this driver. And he was American, of some sort. A legitimate cabbie from San Diego who had agreed on a legitimate price here and back, had paid half paid in advance, half when she was restored to the hotel on Coronado Island, where the sea breezes stirred themselves each afternoon to neutralize the heat. Peasants, she knew. Peasants she dealt with in Paris, where they were alternately surly and unctuous, and Tokyo, where they bowed to the floor and laughed behind your back. But these people frightened her. It was dangerous here. She could sense it. See it with her own eyes. Prostitutes, drunks. That man there, staggering as if he were riding an invisible donkey, his eyes red as some demon, staring belligerently through the window at her. And there, another one, unconscious of the dirt and no more concerned than the dog in his jacket of flies. She was about to open her mouth again, about to say she'd had enough, forget it. She could take her back and away from all this chaos and filth and the ungodly stink, when the car abruptly came to a halt. What, she said, what is it? But the driver, was he Italian, was that it? Merely pointed a finger. It took her a moment, and then she saw the sign, black script, freehand, on a white background. Farmacia. She gathered up her purse and the cloth bag she'd brought along, leaned over the front seat and commanded her voice long enough to say, "You wait now." And then she was out on the street and the sun hit her like an axe. Five steps, a wooden walk, and then the door and the bell that announced her, even as the cab jumped into gear and shot away from the curb with a crunch of tires and a rat-tat-tat of exhaust. She felt the fear seize her then. A cold hand laid on the back of her neck. She was going to die here. She was sure of it. Lost and abandoned in a place where her French was no use to her, or her southern charm either. And her children would never know her, never know about it. Her friends, Frank, no obsequies, no sepulcher, nothing. She'd be like that dog lying bloated on the side of the road. At that moment, as the bell sounded and the door swung back, and she stood there frozen while the taxi receded down the street, two women in mantillas came up the walk behind her, their black hair braided and their eyes ducking away from hers. And what did they want? They wanted to go through the door, that was it. And she was in their way, and they were waiting for her, politely, respectfully. She came to her senses then, murmured an apology, illogically in French, pardon, and stepped into the store. It was close and dark, hotter even, if that was possible, than the street outside. Slowly, as her eyes began to adjust, the features of the place started to take on shape. There were jars everywhere, a cornucopia of jars, and in the jars, various dried herbs and potions, and there were folded, browning sheaves of plants suspended from the ceiling to dry, the smell of them musty and bitter and sweet all at once. And the counter behind which stood a man identical to the spineless physicians and pharmacists of Los Angeles and San Diego counties, right down to the spectacles and the bald dome of his head, except that his skin was the color of the varnish on a very old chest of drawers. Then what was that in the jar at his elbow? Chicken's feet? She thought of the apothecary shop in Romeo and Juliet, the mad mixer of potions. And what was the word she wanted? The word she practiced all the way down here in the cab. Un dormidero, that was it. Un dormidero. But then the man behind the counter smiled at her. A broad, winning, helpful, and welcoming smile. Anything can be purchased here, senora, anything at all. That was what his smile said. And the word flew right out of her head. He said something then, something she didn't catch and couldn't be expected to, but the gist of it was obvious. How may I help you? Feeling better now, feeling herself again, or very nearly, She straightened up and approached the counter, giving him his smile back, even as the two women who'd followed her in browsed among the jars and their mysterious contents. What she said then was contained in a single word, a word she hadn't had to memorize. Morfina. She watched his eyes. Do you understand? His smile widened. He nodded. I want, she said carefully, morfina. She didn't wait till she was back at the hotel, though certainly that would have been more pleasant because she'd been feeling ill and run down and lightheaded all morning. And her stomach was cramping and her bowels weren't right, and no amount of bicarbonate of soda could even begin to help. The man behind the counter, the little brown pharmacist who'd suddenly become her best friend in the world, had given her what she wanted, all she wanted, the only limiting factor the number of dollars she laid out on the tin countertop. Dollars outweighing pesos here, and that was funny since dollar was some sort of nonsense word as far as she knew, and peso was a measure of weight, of gravity itself. And she filled her cloth bag with a dozen tubes of morphine sulfate hypodermic tablets and 10 of the diamorphine hydrochloride. And she got herself some new Provas as well, the needle she carried in her own clever little kit. It was made to resemble an outsized cigarette lighter with room for two tubes and the hypodermic itself, having become blunted through use and unpleasant in the extreme. When the purchase was completed, the two women in shawls watching her surreptitiously and the pharmacist smiling till she thought his head would burst, she gave him another word, which might have been Spanish or maybe it was Latin. Taxi. Taxi, he repeated, as if she just supplied the one term that would make his life complete. Taxi, see, and he shouted, something toward a tumbled nest of straw baskets where a striped Mexican blanket concealed the doorway behind the counter. In the next moment, a boy with his eyes still asleep emerged, took one look at her, and ran out into the street, shouting the magic word. The driver knew not a syllable of English, but San Diego was not an Anglican destination, and the dollars she waved at him immediately bridged any difficulties of interpretation. The sun hammered her briefly, and then she was in the back of the car, everyone grinning now. The pharmacist and the two customers who'd followed her out into the street, the boy and the taxi driver, and even the random passerby, a whole world of dedicated grinning. The door shut on her, the car a tin Lizzie, a flivver, a rat trap of the worst and flimsiest construction. An ancient, the first sedan ever made, but it had a roof and, apparently, an engine. The thing jolted and bumped as if it were pitching headlong down the side of a cliff. The smells assaulted her all over again. The heat crouched atop her, right under the caftan, and she wouldn't take it off, wouldn't show her hair and the sweat and the fright she must have been. But none of that mattered for long, because immediately she was dissolving a tablet in water and drawing it into her provas, and between bumps, finding a vein high up on her right thigh beneath the rolled-up, sweat-soaked hem of her dress. After that, the breezes blew, and the smells dissipated. The man at the border waved them through without a second glance. The world took on a metallic sheen, the sheen of the high seas as seen from the deck chair on the SS Paris. And she wasn't in Mexico anymore. She wasn't in the bleached brown desert of San Diego either, not on land at all. She was on a cruise, perched high up on the rail with the wind in her face and the birds wheeling overhead, on her way back to France. So that's Miriam. And no, so she was a morphine addict, you know? She gave Frank Lloyd Wright a lot of trouble. She was his equal in every way. And as this book progressed, she became my heroine, and she dominates the whole book. And she's pretty damn wonderful as a character, not only as a kind of a comic foil, but also I think you will see if you are to read this book. And incidentally, if it's a long book, I'll give my standard offer. If you want me to come to your house, read it to you out loud, I'll do it for $10,000 an hour. If and when you read this book, you'll find that that she is his match in a lot of ways. She was a little mentally disturbed and a morphine addict. But on the other hand, she had her good points. She was very exotic, very beautiful, and she wanted the attention of the great man. In fact, she wanted to take the attention from the great man, wanted to devour him and be him. And, of course, that's not a good standard for a marriage, a lasting marriage. Now, I think we still have some time left. And, you know, I'd like to give you a little treat, especially seeing Greg there in the front row. I'd like to read you a story as well. Do we have time for that, Andy? How long do we have? An hour or so? A 20-minute story? Okay, this is a new story. I've only read it once. I introduced it at the LA Times Book Fair. And then I'm extremely jealous because on Selected Shorts a month ago, Stephen Colbert read this story, and he got the same reaction I got the first time. And I'm going to try it on you because you're the guinea pigs here. Okay? Can we do that? We can do that. All right, good. We have to shift entirely now. I've just been an elegant middle-aged woman who happened to be a morphine addict. Now I'm going to be a young guy of 25. This story is called The Lie. I'd used up all my sick days and the two personal days they allowed us. But when the alarm went off and the baby started squalling and my wife threw back the covers to totter off to the bathroom in a hobbled two-legged trot, I knew I wasn't going into work. It was as if a black shroud had been pulled over my face. My eyes were open, but I couldn't see. Or no, I could see. The pulsing LED display on the clock radio, the mounds of laundry and discarded clothes humped round the room like the tumuli of the dead, a hard-driving rain drooling down the dark vacancy of the window. But everything seemed to have a film over it, a world coated in Vaseline. The baby let out a series of scaled-back cries. The toilet flushed. The overhead light flicked on. Clover was in the back room, the baby flung over one shoulder. She was wearing an old cramps T-shirt she liked to sleep in and nothing else. I might have found this sexy to one degree or another, but for the fact that I wasn't at my best in the morning, and I'd seen her naked save for one rock and roll memento T-shirt for something like 1,000 consecutive mornings now. It's 6:15, she said. I said nothing. My eyes eased shut. I heard her at the closet, and in the dream that crashed down on me in that instant, she metamorphosed from a rippling human female with a baby slung over one shoulder to a great shining bird springing from the brink of a precipice and sailing on great shining wings out into the void. I woke to the baby, on the bed, beside me. You change her, my wife said. You feed her. I'm late as it is. We'd had some people over the night before, friends from the pre-baby days, and we'd made margaritas in the blender, watched a movie and stayed up late talking about nothing and everything. Clover had shown off the baby, Xana. We'd named her Xana after a character in one of the movies I'd edited, or actually logged. And I felt a rush of pride. Here was this baby, perfect in every way, beautiful because her parents were beautiful. And that was all right. Tank, he'd been in my band, co-leader, co-founder. And we'd written songs together till that went sour. Said she was fat enough to eat. And I'd said, yeah, let me just fire up the Barbie. And Clover had given me her little drawn-down pout of disgust because I was being juvenile. We stayed up till the rain started. I poured one more round of margaritas, and then Tank's girlfriend opened her maw, and a yawn that could have sucked in the whole condo and the street out front, too, and the party broke up. Now I was in bed, and the baby was crawling up my right leg, giving off a powerful reek of shit. The clock inched forward. Clover got dressed, put on her makeup, and took her coffee mug out to the car and was gone. There was nothing heroic in what I did next, dealing with the baby in my own car and the stalled nose-to-tail traffic that made the 3 miles to the babysitters seem like a trek across the wastelands of the earth. It was just life, that was all. But as soon as I handed Xana over to Violetta at the door of her apartment that threw up a wall of cooking smells, tearful Telemundo dialogue, and the diachronic yapping of her four chihuahuas, I slammed myself into the car and called in sick. Or no, not sick. My sick days were gone, I reminded myself, and my personal days, too. My boss picked up the phone. Iron House Productions, he said, his voice digging out from under the R's. He had trouble with R's. He had trouble with English, for that matter. Hello, Radko? Yes, it is he. Who is it now? It's me, Lonnie. Let me guess. You are sick. Radko was one of that select group of hard chargers in the production business who kept morning hours. And that was good for me, because with Clover working days and going to law school at night, and the baby, of course, My own availability was restricted to the daylight hours when Violetta's own children were at school and her husband at work operating one of the cranes that lifted the beams to build the city out till there was nothing green left for 50 miles around. But Radko had promised me career advancement, moving up from logging footage to actual editing. And that hadn't happened. On this particular morning, as on too many mornings in the past, I felt I just couldn't face the editing bay, the computer screen, the eternal idiocy of the dialogue repeated over and over through take after take, frame after frame. No, Jim, stop. No, Jim, stop. No, Jim, stop. I used to be in a band. I had a college degree. I was no drudge. Before I could think, it was out. It's the baby, I said. There was a silence I might have read too much into. Then Radko, dicing the interrogative, said, "What baby?" "Mine, my baby. Remember the pictures Clover emailed everybody?" My brain was doing cartwheels. "9 months ago, when she was born?" Another long pause. Finally, he said, "Yes." "Well, she's sick. Very sick, with fever and all that. We don't know what's wrong with her." The wheel of internal calculus spun one more time, and I made another leap, the one that would prove to be fatal. "I'm at the hospital now." As soon as I hung up, I felt as if I'd been pumped full of helium, giddy with it, rising right up out of my seat. But then the slow seepage of guilt, dread, and fear started in, drip by drip, like bile drained out of a liver gone bad. A delivery truck pulled up next to me. Rain beat at the windshield. Two cholos rolled out of the apartment next to Violetta's, the green block tattoos they wore like collars glistening in the light trapped beneath the clouds. I had the whole day in front of me. I could do anything, go anywhere. An hour ago, it was sleep I wanted. Now it was something else. A pulse of excitement, the promise of illicit thrills, started up in my stomach. I drove down Ventura Boulevard in the opposite direction from the bulk of the commuters. They were stalled at the lights, a single driver in every car, the cars themselves like steel shells they'd extruded to contain their resentments. They were going to work. I wasn't. After a mile or so, I came to a diner where I sometimes took Clover out for breakfast on Sundays, especially if we'd been out the night before. And on an impulse, I pulled into the lot. I bought a newspaper from the machine out front, and then I took a copy of the free paper, too, and went on in and settled into a seat by the window. The smell of fresh coffee and home fries made me realize how hungry I was. And I ordered the kind of breakfast I used to have in college after a night of excess. Salt, sugar, and grease in equal quantities. Just to open up my pores. While I ate, I made my way through both papers, item by item, because this was luxurious, kingly. The tables clean, the place brightly lit and warm to the point of steaming, with the bustle of the waitresses and the rain at the windows like a plague. Nobody said a word to me. Nobody even looked at me, but for my waitress. She was middle-aged, wedded to her uniform, her hair dyed shoe-polish black. "More coffee?" she asked for the third or fourth time. No hurry, no rush, just an invitation. I glanced up at my watch and couldn't believe it was only 9:30. That was the thing about taking a day off, the way the time reconfigured itself, and how you couldn't help comparing any given moment with what you'd be doing at work. At work, I wouldn't have eaten yet. Wouldn't have even reached coffee break. "Jim, stop! No, no!" And my eyelids would have weighed 100 tons each. I thought about driving down to the ocean to see what the surf looked like under the pressure of the storm. Not that I was thinking about surfing. I hadn't been surfing more than a handful of times since the baby was born. It was just that the day was mine and I wanted to fill it. I wound my way down through Topanga Canyon. The computer traffic dissipated by now. And I saw how the creek was tearing at the banks. And there were two or three places where there was water on the road, and the soft red dough of the mud was like something that had come out of a mold. There was nobody on the beach but me. I walked along the shore till the brim of my baseball cap was sodden and the legs of my jeans as heavy as if they'd just come out of the washing machine. I drove back up the canyon, the rain a little worse, the flooding more obvious and intense. But it wasn't anything, really. Not like when the road washes out and you could be driving one minute and the next flailing for your life in a chute full of piss-yellow water. There was a movie or two I was interested in. But since it was only just past 12 and I couldn't even think about lunch after the lumberjack special I'd had for breakfast, I went back to the condo, parked the car, and walked down the street, getting wetter and wetter and enjoying every minute of it, to a bar I knew. The door swung in on a denseness of purpose. 8 or 9 losers lined up on their bar stools, the smell of cut lime and the sunshine of the rum, a straight shot of Lysol from the toilet and back. It was warm, dark. A college basketball game hovered on the screen over the cash register. A beer, I said, and then clarified by specifying the brand. I didn't get drunk. That would have been usual, and I didn't want to be usual. But I did have 3 beers before I went to the movie, and after the movie I felt a vacancy in my lower reaches where lunch should have been, and so I stopped at a fast food place on my way to pick up the baby. They got my order wrong. The employees were glassy-eyed. The manager was nowhere to be seen, and I was 35 minutes late for the baby. Still, I'd had my day. And when I got home, I fed the baby her cream of wheat, opened a beer, put on some music, and began chopping garlic and dicing onions with the notion of concocting a marinara sauce for my wife when she got home. Thoughts of the following morning, of Radko, and what he might think or expect, never entered my mind. Not yet. All was well, the baby in her crib batting at the little figurines in the mobile over her head, the figurines personally welded to the wires by Clover's hippie mother so there wasn't even the faintest possibility the baby could get them lodged in her throat, the sauce bubbling on the stove, the rain tapping at the windows. I heard Clover's key in the door. And then she was there with her hair kinked from the rain and smelling like everything I'd ever wanted. And she was asking me how my day had gone, and I said, fine, just fine. Then it was morning again, and the same scene played itself out. Clover stutter-stepping to the bathroom, the baby mewling, rain whispering under the soundtrack, and I began to calculate all over again. It was Thursday. 2 more days to the weekend. If I could make it to the weekend, I was sure that by Monday at the latest, whatever it was that was wrong with me, this feeling of anger, hopelessness, turmoil, whatever it was, would be gone. Just a break. I just needed a break, that was all. And Radko, the thought of facing him, of the way he would mold the drooping dog-like folds of his Slavic flesh around the suspicion in his eyes while he told me he was docking me a day's pay and expect me to work overtime to make up for yesterday, was too much to hold on to. Not in bed. Not now. But then the toilet flushed, the baby squalled, and the overhead light went on. It's 6:15, my wife informed me. The evening before, after we dined on my marinara sauce with porcini mushrooms and Italian-style turkey sausage over penne pasta, in the interval before she put the baby down for the night while the dishwasher murmured from the kitchen and we lingered over a second glass of Chianti, she told me she was thinking of changing her name. What do you mean? I was more surprised than angry, but I felt the anger come up in me all the same. My name's not good enough for you? Like it was my idea to get married in the first place? She had the baby in her lap. The baby was in high spirits, grinning her toothless baby grin and snatching for the wine glass my wife held just out of reach. You don't have to get nasty about it. It's not your name that's the problem. It's mine, my first name. What's wrong with Clover? I said. And even as I said it, I knew how stupid I sounded. She was Clover. I could close my eyes and she was Clover, go to Africa and bury myself in mud and still she'd be Clover. Fine. But the name was a hippie affectation of her hippie parents. They were glassblowers with their own gallery. And it was insipid, I knew that, down deep. They might as well have named her Dandelion or Fescue. I was thinking of changing it to Chloris. She was watching me, her eyes defiant and insecure at the same time, legally. I saw her point. She was a legal secretary studying to be a lawyer, and Clover just wouldn't fly on a masthead. But I hated the name, hated the idea. Sounds like something you clean the toilet with, I said. She shot me a look of hate. With bleach in it, I said, with real scrubbing power. But now, though I felt as if I had been crucified and wanted only to sleep for a week, till Monday, just till Monday, I sat up before she could lift the baby from the crib and drop her on the bed, and the next moment I was in the bathroom myself, staring into the mirror. As soon as she left, I was going to call Radko. I would tell him the baby was worse, that we'd been in the hospital all night. And if he asked what was wrong with her, I wasn't going to equivocate, because equivocation, any kind of uncertainty, a tremor in the voice, a tonal shift, play acting, is the surest lie detector. Leukemia, that's what I was going to tell him. The baby has leukemia. This time, I waited till I was settled into the booth at the diner and the waitress with the shoe-polished hair had got done fussing over me, the light of recognition in her eyes and a maternal smile creasing her lips. I was a regular 2 days in a row before I called in. And when Radko answered, the deepest, consonant, battering pole of suspicion lodged somewhere between his glottis and adenoids, I couldn't help myself. "The baby," I said, holding it a beat. The baby passed. Another beat. The waitress poured. Radko breathed fumes through the receiver. Last night at 4 a.m., there was nothing they could do. "Past," his voice came back at me. "What is this past?" "The baby's dead," I said. "She died." And then, in my grief, I broke the connection. I spent the entire day at the movies. The first show was at 11, and I killed time pacing around the parking lot at the mall till they opened the doors, and then I was inside in the anonymous dark. Images flashed by on the screen. The sound was amplified to a killing roar. The smell of melted butter hung over everything. When the lights came up, I ducked into the men's room and then slipped into the next theater and the next one after that. I emerged at 4:15, feeling shaky. I told myself I was hungry, that was all. But when I wandered into the food court and saw what they had arrayed there, from chapatis to corn dogs to twice-cooked machaca pretzels and Szechuan eggplant and a sauce of liquid fire, I pushed through the door of a bar instead. It was one of those over-sanitized, too bright, echoing spaces the mall designers, in their wisdom, stuck in the back of their plastic restaurant so the average moron accompanying his wife on a shopping expedition wouldn't have to kill himself. There was a basketball game on the three TVs encircling the bar. The waitresses were teenagers. The bartender had acne. I was the only customer, and I knew I had to pick up the baby. That was a given. That was a fact of life. But I ordered a Captain and Coke just for the smell of it. I was on my second, or maybe my third, when the place began to fill up, and I realized with a stab of happiness that this must have been an after-work hangout, with a prescribed happy hour and some sort of comestible served up gratis on a heated tray. I'd been wrapped up in my grief, a grief that was all for myself, for the fact that I was 26 years old and going nowhere with a baby to take care of and a wife in the process of flogging a law degree and changing her name because she wasn't who she used to be. And now suddenly, I'd come awake. There were women everywhere. Women my age and older, leaning into the bar with their earrings swaying, lined up at the door, sitting at tables, legs crossed, feet tapping rhythmically to the canned music. Me? I had to pick up the baby. I checked my watch and saw that I was already late, late for the second day running. But I was hungry all of a sudden, and I thought I'd maybe just have a couple of the taquitos everybody else was shoving into their mouths while I finished my drink, and then I'd get in the car, take the back streets to Violetta's, and be home just before my wife and see if we could get another meal out of the marinara sauce with porcini mushrooms and turkey sausage. That was when I felt a pressure on my arm, my left arm, and I lifted my chin to glance over my shoulder into the face of Joel Chinowski, who occupied the bay next to mine at Iron House Productions. At first, I didn't recognize him, one of those tricks of the mind, the inebriated mind especially, in which you can't place people out of context, though you know them absolutely. "Joel," I said. He was shaking his head very slowly, as if he were tolling a bell, as if his eyes were the clappers and his skull the ringing shell of it. He had a big head, huge. He was big all around, one of those people who aren't obese or not exactly, but just overgrown to the extent that his clothes seemed inflated, his pants, his jacket, even his socks. He was wearing a tie, the only one of the 76 employees at Iron House to dress in shirt and tie, and it looked like a toy trailing away from his supersized collar. "Shit, man," he said, squeezing tighter. "Oh, shit." "Yeah," I said, and my head was tolling too. I felt caught out, felt like the very essence he was naming, shit, that is. "Yeah, we all heard," he said. He removed his hand from my arm, peered into his palm as if trying to divine what to say next. "It sucks," he said. It really sucks." "Yeah," I said. And then, though his face never changed expression, he seemed to brighten around the eyes for just an instant. "Hey," he said, "can I buy you a drink? I mean, to drown the sorrow. I mean, that's what you're doing, right? And I don't blame you, not at all. I mean, if it was me..." He let the thought trail off. There was a girl, two stools down from me, her hair pulled up in a long, trailing ponytail, and she was wearing a knit jumper over a little black skirt and red leggings. She glanced up at me, two green swimming eyes above a pair of lips pursed at the straw of her drink. "Or maybe," Joel said, "you'd rather be alone?" I dragged my eyes away from the girl. "Well, the truth is, Joel," I said, I mean, I really appreciate it, but like, I'm meeting Clover at the funeral parlor. You know, to make the arrangements. And it's, well, I just stopped for a drink, that's all. Oh, man. Joel was practically erupting from his shoes, his face drawn down like a curtain and every blood vessel in his eyes gone to waste. "I understand. I completely understand." On the way out the door, I flipped open my cell and dialed Violetta to tell her my wife would be picking up the baby tonight because I was working late. And then I left a message to the same effect at my wife's law office. Then I went looking for a bar where I could find something to eat and maybe one last drink before I went home to lie some more. The next day, Friday, I didn't even bother to call in. But I was feeling marginally better. I had a mild hangover, my head still clanging dully, and my stomach shriveled up around a little nugget of nothing so that after I dropped the baby off, I wasn't able to take anything more than dry toast and black coffee at the diner that was fast becoming my second home. And yet the force of it, that lie, the enormity of it, it was behind me. And here, outside the windows, the sun was shining for the first time in days. I'd been listening to the surf report in the car on the way over. We were getting 6-foot swells as a result of the storm. And after breakfast, I dug out my wetsuit and my board and let the Pacific roll on under me until I forgot everything in the world but the taste of salt and the smell of the breeze and the weird, strangled cries of the gulls. I was home by 3, and I vacuumed, washed the dishes, scrubbed the counters. I was 20 minutes early to pick up Zanna, and while dinner was cooking, meatloaf with boiled potatoes in their skins and asparagus vinaigrette, I took her to the park and listened to her screech with baby joy as I held her in my lap and rocked higher and higher on the swings. When Clover came home, she was too tired to fight, and she accepted the meatloaf and the wine I'd picked out as the peace offerings they were. And after the baby was asleep, we listened to music, smoked the joint, and made love in a slow, deep plunge that was like paddling out on a wave of flesh for what seemed like hours. We took a drive up the coast on Saturday, and on Sunday afternoon, we went over to Tank's for lunch and saw how sad his apartment was with its brick and board bookcases, the faded band posters curling away from the walls, and the deep pile rug that was once off-white and was now just plain dirty. In the car on the way home, Clover said she could never understand people who treated their dog as if they'd given birth to it, and I shook my head, tolling it, but easily now, thankfully, and said, "I couldn't agree more." I woke on Monday before the alarm went off, and I was showered and shaved and in the car before my wife left for work. And when I pulled up in front of the long, windowless, gray stucco edifice that housed Iron House Productions, I was so early Radko himself hadn't showed up yet. I took off my watch and stuffed it deep in my pocket, letting the monotony of work drag me down till I was conscious of nothing, not my fingers at the keyboard or the image on the screen or the dialogue I was capturing frame by frozen frame. Log and capture, that was what I was doing, hour, minute, second, frame, transcribing everything that had been shot so the film's editor could locate what he wanted without going through the soul-crushing drudgery of transcribing it himself. At some point, it must have been an hour in, 2 hours, I don't know, I became aware of the intense, gland-clenching aroma of vanilla chai, hot, spiced, blended, the very thing I wanted, caffeine to drive a stake into the boredom. Vanilla chai, available at the coffee house down the street, but a real indulgence because of the cost. Usually I made do with the acidic black coffee and artificial creamer Radko provided on a stained cart set up against the back wall. I lifted my head to search out the aroma, and there was Jeannie, the secretary from the front office, holding a paperboard venti in one hand and a platter of what turned out to be homemade cannoli in the other. "What?" I said, thinking Radko had sent her to tell me he wanted to see me in his office. But she didn't say anything for a long, excruciating moment, her eyes full, her face white as a mask. And then she shoved the chai into my hand and set the tray down on the desk beside me. "I am so sorry for your loss," she said. And then I felt her hand on my shoulder, and she was dipping forward in a typhoon of perfume to plant a lugubrious kiss just beneath my left ear. What can I say? I felt bad about the whole business, felt low and despicable. But I cracked the plastic lid and sipped the chai. And as if I weren't conscious of what my fingers were doing, I started in on the cannoli, one by one, till the platter was bare. I was just sucking the last of the sugar from my fingertips when Steve Bartholomew, a guy of 30 or so who worked in special effects, a guy I barely knew, came up to me and without a word pressed a tin of butter cookies into my hand. "Hey," I said, addressing his retreating shoulders. "Thanks, man. Thanks. It means a lot." By noon, my desk was piled high with foodstuffs. Sandwiches, sweets, a dry salami as long as my forearm, and at least a dozen gray-jacketed sympathy cards inscribed by one worker, co-worker, or another. I wanted to hide. Wanted to quit. Wanted to go home, tear the phone out of the wall, get into bed, and never leave. But I didn't. I just sat there trying to work, giving one person after another a zombie smile and my best impression of the thousand-yard stare. Just before quitting time, Radko appeared, his face like an old paper bag left out in the rain. He was flanked by Joel Chinowski. I glanced up at them out of wary eyes, and in a flash of intuition, I realized how much I hated them both, how much I wanted only to jump to my feet like a cornered animal and punch them out, both of them. Radko said nothing. He just stood there gazing down at me, and then, after a moment, he pressed one hand to my shoulder in Slavic commiseration, turned and walked away. "Listen, man," Joel said, shifting his eyes away from mine. "We all wanted to, well, we got together, me and some of the others, and I know it isn't much, but..." I saw now that he was holding a plastic grocery sack in one hand. I knew what was in the sack. I tried to wave it away, but he thrust it at me, and I had no choice but to take it. Later, when I got home and the baby was in her high chair, smearing her face with cream of wheat, and I'd slipped the microwave pizza out of its box, I sat down and emptied the contents of the bag on the kitchen table. It was mainly cash, but there were maybe half a dozen checks, too. I saw one for $25, another for $50. The baby made one of those expressions of baby joy, sharp and sudden, as if the impulse had seized her before she could process it. It was 5:30, and the sinking sun was pasted over the windows. I sifted the bills through my hands, tens and twenties, fives, a lot of fives, and surprisingly few singles, thinking how generous my co-workers were, how good and real and giving. But I was grieving all the same, grieving beyond any measure I could ever have imagined or contained. I was in the process of counting the money, thinking I'd give it back or donate it to some charity, when I heard Clover's key in the lock, and I swept it all back into the bag and tucked that bag in the deep recess under the sink where the water persistently dripped and the crusted-over pipe and the old sponge there smelled of mold. The minute my wife left in the morning, I called Radko and told him I wasn't coming in. He didn't ask for an excuse, but I gave him one anyway. "The funeral," I said. "It's at 11 a.m., just family, very private. My wife's taking it hard." He made some sort of noise on the other end, a sigh, a belch, the faintest cracking of his knuckles. "Tomorrow," I said. "I'll be in tomorrow without fail." And then the day began. But it wasn't like that first day, not at all. I didn't feel giddy, didn't feel liberated, or even relieved. All I felt was regret and the cold drop of doom. I deposited the baby at Violetta's and went straight home to bed, wanting only to clear some space for myself and think things out. There was no way I could return their money. I wasn't that good of an actor. And I couldn't spend it either, even to make up for the loss of pay. That would have been low, lower than anything I'd ever done in my life. I thought of Clover then, how furious she'd be when she found out my pay had been docked. If it had been docked. There was still a chance Radko would let it slide, given the magnitude of my tragedy, a chance that he was human after all, a good chance. No, the only thing to do was bury the money someplace. I'd burn the checks first. I couldn't run the risk of anybody uncovering them. That would be a real disaster, magnitude 10. Nobody could explain that. Though various scenarios were already suggesting themselves. A thief had stolen the bag from the glove box of the car. It had blown out the window on the freeway while I was on my way to the mortuary. The neighbor's pet macaque had come in through the open window and made off with it, wadding the checks and chewing up the money till it was just monkey feces now. Monkey feces. I found myself repeating the phrase over and over as if it were a prayer. Monkey feces. It was a little past 9 when I had my first beer. And for the rest of the day, till I had to pick up the baby, I never moved from the couch. I tried to gauge Clover's mood when she came in the door, dressed like a lawyer in a gray herringbone jacket and matching skirt, her hair pinned up and her eyes in traffic mode. The place was a mess. I hadn't picked up, hadn't put on anything for dinner. The baby, asleep in her molded plastic carrier, gave off a stink you could smell all the way across the room. I looked up from my beer. I thought we'd go out tonight, I told her. My treat. And then, because I couldn't help myself, I added, I'm just trashed from work. She wasn't happy about it. I could see that. Lawyerly calculations transfiguring her face as she weighed the hassle of running up the boulevard with husband and baby in tow before leaving for her 8 o'clock class. I watched her reach back to remove the clip from her hair and shake it loose. "I guess," she said, "but no Italian." She set down her briefcase in the entry hall where the phone was, and she put a thumb in her mouth a moment, a habit of hers. She was a fingernail chewer. Before she said, "What about Chinese?" She shrugged before I could. "As long as it's quick, I don't really care." I was about to agree with her, about to rise up out of the grip of the couch and do my best to minister to the baby and get us out the door en famille, when the phone rang. Clover answered. "Hello? Uh-huh, this is she." My right knee cracked as I stood, a reminder of the torn ACL I'd suffered in high school when I'd made the slightest miscalculation regarding the drop off the backside of a boulder while snowboarding at Mammoth. "Jeannie?" my wife said, her eyebrows lifting in two perfect arches. "Yes," she said. "Yes, Jeannie, how are you?" There was a long pause as Jeannie said what she was going to say, and then my wife said, "Oh, no, there must be some mistake. The baby's fine. She's right here in the carrier, fast asleep." And her voice grew heartier, surprise and confusion riding the cusp of the joke. She could use a fresh diaper, judging from the smell of it, but that's her daddy's job, or it's going to be if we ever expect to. And then there was another long pause, even longer this time. And I watched my wife's gaze shift from the form of the sleeping baby in her terry cloth jumpsuit to where I was standing beside the couch. Her eyes, in soft focus for the baby, hardened as they climbed from my shoe tops to my face, where they rested like two balls of granite. Anybody would have melted under that kind of scrutiny. My wife, the lawyer. It would be a long night, I could see that. There would be no Chinese, no food of any kind. I found myself denying everything, telling her how scattered Jeannie was and how she must have mixed it up with the Lovitts. You remember Tony Lovett? Worked in SFX? Yeah, they just lost their baby, a little girl. Yeah, you know, it was awful. I told her we'd all chipped in. Me too, I put in a 50, and that was excessive, I know it, but I felt I had to, you know, because of the baby, because what if it happened to us? I went on in that vein till I ran out of breath, and when I tried to be nonchalant about it and go to the refrigerator for another beer, she blocked my way. "Where's the money?" she said. We were 2 feet apart. I didn't like the look she was giving me because it spared nothing. I could have kept it up, could have said, "What money?" injecting all the trampled innocence I could summon into my voice, but I didn't. I merely bent to the cabinet under the sink, extracted the white plastic bag, and handed it to her. She took it as if it were the bleeding corpse of our daughter, or no, of our relationship that went back 3 years to the time when I was on stage, gilded in light, my message elided under the hammer of the guitar and the thump of the bass. She didn't look inside. She just held my eyes. "You know this is fraud, don't you? A felony offense? They can lock you up for this. You know that?" She wasn't asking a question. She was making a demand. And I wasn't about to answer her, because the baby was dead, and she was dead too. Radko was dead. Jeannie, the secretary, whose last name I didn't even know, and Joel Chinowski and all the rest of them. Very slowly, button by button, I did up my shirt. Then I set my empty beer bottle down on the counter as carefully as if it were full to the lip, and went on out the door and into the night, looking for somebody I could tell all about it. Thanks, folks. I wasn't supposed to read you that story, but I couldn't help it because you're so physically beautiful. And so now we'll take questions for a bit.
Andy? Folks, you probably know the way this works. Raise your hand. We'll get you a mic. And who would like to start us off? Gentleman in the reddish-orange back there. If you could keep your hand up, please.
Hi, Mr. Boyle. Thanks for coming. Big fan. Been reading you for years.
Thank you.
Two-part question for you. I know you're not a genre writer, but you've almost kind of created your own subgenre with these novels that you've written about the 20th century figures, the mm-hmm. egomaniacs.
Yes.
And I've been kind of thinking about that. And the first part of the question is, how did you've created kind of a model in which there's a person from real life, and there's at least one or two imagined or fictional characters around that person. Mm-hmm. How did you first arrive at that kind of model for writing your historical novels? And the second part of my question is,
Let me answer the first, and then you can remember the second.
Thank you.
Good question. These little bits of history that I give to you in books like The Inner Circle and The Road to Wellville and now the new one fascinate me. These three figures have had an enormous influence on our lives. I mean, we eat cornflakes, we have sex, and we live in houses. I mean, come on. Much more so than politicians or, you know, presidents or anybody else. And their lives were so complex and bizarre in the truth of history that I couldn't help having fun with them. However, I never want to repeat myself. And so in this one, I should tell you the format of the book. It's a very complex and interesting structure, which I think you'll enjoy. What is the truth of history? What is the truth of any event that's occurred? You know, there are something like 1,000 books have been written about Frank Lloyd Wright and his work. And even the 9 biographies and memoirs I cite here in this, even they have differences of tone and approach, and even the facts sometimes are mysterious. So what I'm giving you is a novel that is narrated by an invented character. And how I got to this, I don't know. I just do what comes natural. Anyway, the inventor character, Tadashi Sato, who was an apprentice in the 30s at Taliesin. And he gives three long introductions to the three major parts of the book, which are in third person. And his is in first person. And he has done this as a memoir for his master, Raito-san. But in a sly Nabokovian wink, and there are lots of footnotes in this, by the way, written by Tadashi. There's a question as to how much he knows English and how it was translated by his grandson-in-law, O'Flaherty-san, who is a failed novelist. And so there's all these questions of what's true and what's not. On the other hand, I love the truth of Frank Lloyd Wright's life, like Miriam, like you heard about Miriam. How could you invent a woman like Miriam? And this is just the beginning of what you'll see from her, the scandals and the craziness that were true. I mean, I got the stuff from the newspapers of the day. You couldn't invent it. So then we have the novelization of the third-person parts from their points of view, as you heard me read, in addition to the first-person parts. So it gives this whole complex weave, and the invented characters interpret the actual characters.
Moving right along, another question? Yeah, did you remember?
Come on, don't be shy, folks. Andy told me I haven't been in this auditorium since
2000, September 2000. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll be back in 20 years. You can ask me then. Greg?
Oh, right in front here. Can we get the mic to this gentleman?
Thanks. I know from talking with you on a number of occasions that you and I sort of share the same jaundiced view of the future of the human race. And writing a novel, it seems to me, or writing a story is kind of an act of hope. And I'm kind of wondering if you think about that or if you feel that that's true for you or if there's a way you reconcile those
two views. I do indeed.
You
see how delightful I am and how happy I am and quite a joker. But as Greg knows, deep down in my soul, I have the blackest view of everything that could possibly happen to humankind. Read A Friend of the Earth and you'll know all about it. Yes, art is hope. Art redeems us. Art is our way of interpreting the world and communicating with each other. And it's the only thing for me that exists. It's a great, great honor that I have to be able to dream for a couple hours each day and then present it to you. And also, it's a way of controlling the world. Because I have to admit, you know, I'm a little bit of a narcissist and a crazy person like Frank Lloyd Wright, and I am a control freak. And I don't like the parameters of human life. I don't like the mystery. I don't like death. I don't like any of it. But when I create the world, then I am in control of it. It's my world. I am the god of these worlds. And by God, my characters are going to suffer.
And how to follow that up all the way back there.
Mr. Boyle, it's a privilege and honor to hear you speak today. I've been reading your novels since about 1995 from college, and I was introduced to you by one of my professors in postmodernism. I don't know if you fall on that, but but sort of a follow-up to what he was saying is that it seems that literature today is more materialistic in nature. You read it once and it's done, just like you kind of bought underwear.
Yeah.
And what I'm wondering is, do you feel that that will change? Do you feel that, you know, we're going to kind of go back to creativity and where, you know, meaning actually meant something? And do you think that art will be able to pull us through that?
Well, everything sucks, I agree. But on the other hand, I think the book industry has always been that way. It's always been like this. Here we were speaking to the anointed. I mean, look at the brilliant people here. They come to hear literature. This is literature. This is the real deal. But, you know, most of the public is watching TV, and those who are not are reading, you know, vampire books and the rest of it. So that's the way it has always been, and those books will always predominate. In fact, it's been 2.5 years since I came out with Talk Talk, and I finished this book in the summer of 07, so it should have been summer last year or fall last year, but you probably heard about it. There was some kind of election or something going on, so we held the book, and it coincided with the centennial of the house. Great, you know. But, you know, I just keep going and hoping for the best. And in the interval, the New York Times developed a new paperback bestseller list. It had only been trade paperbacks, which was dominated by, you know, all the crap books and, you know, about dogs and so on. So they then had trade paperbacks, and real literature was there. And I thought, man, this is my chance. I can get on there. But no. The sly publishers of the mass market simply took their Grishams and their Ludlums and the rest of them and put them into trade paperback as well, so they dominate both lists. See, if I were in charge, I would have mass market, but I wouldn't call it mass market. I'd call it crap, and I'd call it real stuff on the other side.
Gentleman in the blue right here.
So your novels all seem to have a lot in common with your novels, and your short stories have a lot in common with your short stories. They're very different, it seems, and I was curious sort of what the difference is to you and if you find either of them more rewarding or challenging or anything like that.
I'm very lucky in that I do both, and I like to think that I do both equally well. Most writers are one or the other. Everything to me is just a story, whether it's 5 pages or 20 pages or like you just heard here or 450, like this book here, and I just have an idea of what complexity it needs. And so, and I also very consciously have periods of writing novels, succeeded by periods of writing stories, and when the ideas peter out, then I write another novel. So I like both forms equally, and to switch from one to the other is kind of a breath of fresh air. Because we held this book back in the interval, next year at this very time, when this paperback comes out, I will have the new collection of 14 new stories called Wild Child, and I'm 2/3 of the way through the new novel, which I hope to finish this summer for the following year. It's called When the Killing's Done, and it deals with the ecological restoration of the Channel Islands off of Santa Barbara, which is an amazing story. And I was out there this summer. By the way, I don't know if you know about this. Because of island biogeography, these islands have been separated for a given period, and so there has been dwarfism occurred. So we have unique species there. We have the dwarf fox, the island fox, which is the size of a house cat and looks like Disney created it. It's quite amazing. I was out there this summer with the fox lady checking the traps to see how they're doing and see their teeth and so on, and they are... they're amazing. They don't snarl. They don't run away. They're just there. You hold them and you check their teeth and so on. And it's just an amazing and beautiful thing. And by the way, the fox lady is the toughest woman in the world. It's like joining the Marine Corps. 5 a.m. up and down these hills that are just like this wall here, just like this wall. And there are 24 traps and there's a little flag. And once you get to the top and you're just about dead, then you see the next flag and it's on the next cliff way over there. It's a great experience, though.
T. Corragison Boyle.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.